Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast about nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Kay, and I use pronouns like she and her.
And I'm Pastor Emily, and my pronouns are they, them, theirs. In this episode, we'll discuss the 11th Sunday after Pentecost, also known as Lectionary 19 or Proper 14, which this year falls on August 13th. Just as a heads up for folks for next week, because we have, you know, lives and stuff.
Yay.
Yes. Next week's episode will come out a day late, so keep an ear out for it on Tuesday. If we can get it up before Tuesday, then we will, but it definitely won't be up at our usual Monday morning time. So, sorry about that. Thank you for your understanding, and make sure you check it out because it'll be a great one. We have one content notification for this episode. We talk briefly about the practice of fasting in our deep dive.
Absolutely, and thank you. Check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode.
This week, for our deep dive, with all of the silence and alone time, we figured, especially with Elijah, we figured we would talk about silent or contemplative practices, especially the ones that are actually silent or have the option of being silent.
Yes, but they don't require you to be the silence as in Doctor Who. That would be complicated.
That would be scary.
Although you might be, I suppose.
It's true. It's true. But now that raises the question of whether or not God is the silent.
But God is not silent.
But the sound of sheer silence is God's presence.
One of God's presences. God was also the great rushing wind in Pentecost. And so
it's true.
It's true. And, you know, has occasionally set things on fire, which is very rarely silent.
That's true. I think people sometimes think that fire is silent. It is not. It is a noisy thing.
Yeah.
Delightfully noisy.
Sometimes. It depends on what's on fire, I suppose, on whether or not it's delightful.
True.
Speaking of which, go back and listen to our Pentecost deep dive into fire, as we recently did.
Indeed.
However, today our subject is silent spiritual practices. And to start off, it makes sense for us to first talk about silent prayer and or contemplative prayer. Silent prayer is simply prayer where you're not, you know, talking out loud. And lots of us do this. Sometimes it's specifically as morning or evening prayer. Sometimes people do this at the table as part of a table grace. Plenty of table graces can be done silently. Contemplative prayer is a slightly different thing that's a little different for everyone and has been practiced in many different ways. When I arrived at my first pastoral internship site, I discovered that the previous pastoral intern had started a contemplative prayer group that wanted to continue. And this is not especially one of my gifts. It's not entirely because of the ADHD, because actually, since my ADHD hyperactivity can be expressed as mental hyperactivity, I can absolutely sit in silence for great lengths of time. But am I going to be praying during those great lengths of time? Not necessarily. But contemplative prayer tends to either be focused on listening for God's voice, which it's awfully hard to listen if you're not being reasonably quiet, or sometimes contemplative prayer will have you focus on one thought, concept, or subject, and allow yourself to have sort of a silent conversation with God about that subject in prayer. And so there are many different ways that that can manifest itself, but like I said, it's not something I'm spectacularly gifted at myself. So,
yeah, I am also not particularly gifted at that. I can do it. It just does not resonate with me in the same way. So this is a particularly hilarious topic for the two of us to be covering.
Yeah, kind of.
But it also opens a space for ways of engaging with silent and contemplative practices that are maybe not the ones that we normally think of. So there are like guided meditations and those sorts of things, which are not actually silent, but you can definitely find a bunch of them and kind of a guided prayer stuff online if you do easy Google searches. But my favorite contemplative prayer is praying in color which comes from a book by Sybil Macbeth called Praying in Color. And I think of it as doodle purrs. You can have music on in the background, but you don't have to. But the goal is to spend time, instead of listing your worry list to God, spend time with one person or situation that you want to pray for and about, and just spend time with God and that person or that situation and doodle. So use a word or phrase to represent that person or situation, and then just doodle around that, and you kind of create your own prayer icon that you can put up somewhere so that every time you see it, you're reminded and brought back to that situation or that person. And whenever, if you use like just a couple colors in a color scheme, then whenever you see those colors out in the world, it provides another reminder of the prayer that you have for that situation or that person.
Yeah,
I love it. And there's lots of different ways that you can use it. She goes through like a digital way to do it that did not at all connect with me, but I imagine would connect with folks who are more into digital aspects of art and creativity and stuff. But yeah, highly recommend. It's great to do with kids. You can do it with groups too. It doesn't have to be by yourself silent. Yeah. Another silent contemplative practice is a prayer labyrinth. These come in a variety of different sizes. A lot of camps especially, but like camps or sometimes congregations or cathedrals or places will set up prayer labyrinths that you can walk. Either they will have them permanently established or will have them out for Lent or something. And so usually if they're temporary ones, you take off your shoes and then you just walk along this, what seems like a maze, but it doesn't have any wrong turns. Yeah. But you walk along this circular-ish maze until you get to the center, and then stay at the center for however long you need to stay at the center, and then come out. And some of them, you can, there's a path to go out directly, and some of them you retrace your steps. And yeah. So as you are walking, that is the space to pray and to just kind of hold that space. And that there's something about like repetitive motion, like walking,
yes,
that can really connect with people. And not everybody has access to a huge walking human labyrinth. And so another option is there are a lot of ways to get pocket labyrinths. Some people make them like out of clay so that you can run your finger through it and feel the grooves and the ridges and stuff. You can definitely, like, there are plenty that you can print out the labyrinth.
Yeah.
For folks, but that can also, if you're like in your office or at home or somewhere where you can't get up and walk, running your finger through the prayer labyrinth can also provide a sense of what you would get out of walking it or rolling it or moving physically through it.
I would also say that if you're looking for a more physical connection to a labyrinth that you have printed out, I have occasionally known folks to use fabric puff paint on a printed out labyrinth to trace over the lines. And that way you still get the layered physical connection, sort of, by adding a little bit more dimension to it.
You don't have to necessarily watch it to do it.
And while I have always wanted to walk a labyrinth in the outfit that the main character Sarah in the movie The Labyrinth wears, you should not necessarily expect David Bowie to be in the center of the labyrinth dressed as the Goblin King. So
it's true. It's true. Don't expect a Goblin King at the center of the labyrinth. Yeah. I think you could also like embroider a labyrinth if you were an embroiderer, right?
Sure.
To do embroidery, I imagine there's some sort of knitting or crochet pattern that might also work for prayer labyrinths, which we'll get into those as their own contemplative practices, but that also could be a good way to connect if you want to connect some creativity with that and have an accessible, travelable labyrinth for yourself.
Yeah.
Also, one of the other silent-ish contemplative prayers is the breath prayer. And there are a lot of different ways of doing it, but part of it comes from the tradition that our first breath and our last breath, and in fact every breath, is a naming of God. So the Tetragrammaton, which we've talked about on this podcast before, the like proper name of God, the letters that make it up are very breathy. And so there's this sense of like your breath in being Yah, and so you go Yah. And then breathing out can be a way. And so you can say that. I would not say it in the company of Jewish people because that gets into their own practices around the proper name of God. You can do that with that proper name of God, or you can also do it with like a sentence of like breathe, or like breathing in that which affirms you and breathing out that which harms you, breathing in God's call for justice and breathing out the oppression that influences all of us, those sorts of things. So you can pick whatever you would like to pick, but to then kind of visualize it especially, but also if you need or want to, you can use words as you breathe in and breathe out. Sometimes you slow your breathing. You're not supposed to like try to slow your breathing, but like just to let your breathing be and be deep
and keep breathing.
Yes, keep breathing whole time. Don't stop breathing.
Right.
Yeah, never stop breathing, please.
Well, immortality is complicated.
I mean, okay.
Fair. We are just delighted our listeners are with us and hope that you can keep listening to us forever. That's all.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at.
Sure. So, related to silent and contemplative prayer, you may have also heard of how the Quakers have been known to practice worship, also known commonly as waiting worship, which is a very different structure of worship than what a lot of, say, Catholic or Protestant Christians are familiar with. Mm-hmm. And rather than being liturgical or non-liturgical, waiting worship is a practice where a group of people get together in a place and they wait to see what the Holy Spirit does among them. I was honored to preach at a Quaker meeting a few years ago during the worst of the pandemic when all worship was over Zoom. And the way they practiced it was they had a half hour of what was fairly standard worship in my experience, in that we had a couple of prayers and a scripture reading, and I delivered a short sermon. Mm-hmm. And then the second half hour together was spent in waiting worship, which was people waiting for the Holy Spirit to inspire them to say something, to add to the conversation. And some Quakers have also practiced waiting worship exclusively and not had that first more what Lutherans would call liturgical type of worship beforehand. Mm-hmm. And so this is a practice that goes back hundreds of years. And there are also plenty of other Christian traditions that will have space for waiting for the Holy Spirit to speak through us in worship. But the waiting worship of the Quakers is, I think, the best known type.
Yeah. So. And there are just a lot of ways in which Quakers incorporate silence just in general in their practices. Yeah. Like when I was in college, I went to a conference and we did, I forget what it was called, but it was a Quaker practice of someone coming to the group with a dilemma or a question or something. And then the group is only able to ask questions, not give advice, not give answers. But it started with a significant time of silence.
Sure.
Before like actually getting into it. And so I just think in general, in Quaker practice, I'm always like in awe of the length of time that they're able to do silence, because I've done it with people, and people get like, Lutherans especially, get really antsy really fast.
Oh yeah, no, we are not comfortable silence.
So it takes some cultivation, but I think it's a really helpful thing. And I know some congregations like start with a singing bowl or something to like give people a space of silence, and then the singing bowl can welcome them into worship. But yeah.
And then, of course, related to worship, there is also Bible study, which if you are practicing Bible study on your own, solo, then often that will be somewhat silent, assuming that you don't manage to, you know, drop any of the books you're using or your iPad. And as you're doing Bible study on your own, there are many useful resources out there available to you. Since we are talking about spiritual practices today, I thought I would suggest the Life with God Bible, which is out of the Renovare resources. And while many study Bibles out there exist to tell you more about the biblical times and life back then, and more about the original languages and what those words meant, that kind of thing, the Life with God Bible is unusual in that all of the notes and margins and footnotes are aimed at how these verses relate to different spiritual practices, several of which are silent. And so if you are looking to explore new spiritual practices or just reinforce your current practice of them, the Life with God Bible can be a really lovely way to explore those. I've really appreciated it.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, I thought it was a really interesting way to orient the notes for a study Bible. And I suppose you might call it a spiritual practices Bible instead. And then also, you know that we here at Nerds at Church love the Our Bible app, because mm-hmm. we once did a deep dive with the founder and head of the Our Bible app. They do great work.
Mm-hmm. And we're on it.
Yes, and we are. And so they have lots of great resources, including us, but not just us. And we are delighted to suggest them to just about anybody, really, as long as you can use an app.
It's true. It's true. And it's part of why we specifically suggest them and the Life with God Bible, is that there are a lot of Bible studies out there. And there are a lot that have theology that causes harm. And so the ones that we are talking about specifically, the Our Bible app in particular, is really intended and centers and roots marginalized people. So the Our Bible app is very like queer, trans, Black, Indigenous, people of color centered. They are good with disability, like all of that stuff, in a way that takes a lot of effort to sort through for your average like Google search.
Yeah. And while to my knowledge, the Life with God Bible was compiled in large part by a bunch of straight white people, I have used it fairly extensively, and I have not personally found any terrifying or terrible theology or harmful stuff in it. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying I have read it cover to cover, but yeah, I have found it helpful. So
yeah. And if you have or have had a different experience with either of those or have other ideas, let us know. We're glad to share Absolutely. With folks other options for spiritual practices and for Bible studies in particular that might resonate with them.
Yeah.
Another silent contemplative practice is fasting. So fasting is a practice that is complicated, to say the least. Fasting is not intended to be like a diet. There is medical fasting that you do before like labs or operations or procedures or whatever, but
yeah, please follow your doctor's instructions.
Follow those. And even like in the many traditions where fasting is a practice, Islam is probably the most well known for fasting, actually. And that is because there is an entire month of Ramadan where Muslims practice fasting from sunup to sundown. And even then, right, if you are pregnant, if you are young enough, if you have medical reasons, you are not expected to fast, right? In any tradition where fasting is a practice, it is not intended to cause you physical harm. It is intended right. to kind of clear out the rest of all of the things and create this space, open up this space for you to be more present with God.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's in a biblical sense. Sometimes we see it used as a form of lament. That's a common practice in Judaism, is when there is fasting. I believe it's before Yom Kippur. And there are a couple different holy days where it's times of lament. And that's fasting can be a time of lament. Most Christians who fast will do it either at the very beginning of Lent, either leading up to or starting with Ash Wednesday, or maybe fast from something in Lent. Or the Catholic tradition that my grandmother had was no meat on Fridays during Lent. So kind of all of those options, but there are different ways to do it. And it's very important to do it for the right reasons and to know that it is not an inherently better practice than everybody else or anything like that. It is just a practice that works for some and doesn't for others.
Yeah. And so when it comes to fasting, we have expanded our concept of it in the last 2,000 years of Christianity, certainly, because, mm-hmm. you know, it's been a while and we've had some time to experiment. And so when we fast, it's, again, not always about food. For mm-hmm. example, in the Christian practice, there has historically been a concept called keeping the Sabbath, which, of course, is related to a commandment. Exactly which one depends on which Christian tradition you follow. But when we keep the Sabbath, part of the historical way of doing so has been to fast from non-church or faith-related activities and entertainment. And so you might go for a walk to enjoy creation on the Sabbath, but you wouldn't read a book for your math class. Or mm-hmm. you might do a little Bible study on the Sabbath, but you wouldn't do a chore that didn't absolutely have to be done that day, or a chore that wasn't related to faith or the church. And so keeping the Sabbath, the idea was that you sort of cleared away other parts of your life for one day in order to focus on God. And that's very much what fasting is about, or supposed to be about anyway. Another way to fast that does not involve food is that some folks will practice solitude as a spiritual discipline. Mm-hmm. And this can just mean taking a certain amount of time for yourself to be alone with God and to focus on God during that time. That time might be silent. It might not be, depending on what you're doing. Sometimes people practice solitude by going for walks or practicing a musical instrument or any number of other ways. But also people will choose sometimes to practice silence as a spiritual discipline, and you can do this either alone or with others. Again, we already talked about the Quakers.
Also, when you're doing something like that where you're taking up a practice, especially if it's new to you, and especially if you maybe haven't had as much success in taking up new practices in the past, it's always good to start small, especially if you are not used to silence, right? And you're trying to do
solitude,
maybe start with 30 seconds even, or a minute.
Yeah.
And slowly build each day, add a minute until you get to where you want to go, or until you get to a place where you're like, okay, this feels like a good amount.
That's enough.
That I can sustain regularly. And you don't have to increase every day. You can do the same amount for a week, and then the next week try to increase, or that sort of a thing.
Sure.
But that it's helpful to do it in baby steps, not to try and do it all at once.
Yeah, some of us may be familiar with the historical practice of practicing silence as a spiritual discipline as done in religious communities through the centuries by monks and nuns. And they would sometimes spend hours or even days in silence. And that took a lot of practice. It took a lot of work to get there. That is a genuine accomplishment. And so don't sprain something while you're trying for something that it took even people hundreds of years ago a lot of work to get to. So the idea that it would take time and, you know, actual practice to get to that point should not be a surprise. And then also another way of fasting that has been practiced through the centuries is, of course, meditation. We already spoke about silent and or contemplative prayer. Meditation, unlike prayer, is not necessarily directed specifically at God, but might also be directed toward creation or toward your inner self to better understand yourself or while considering a particular topic or concern. And there are many different ways to practice meditation, and you don't necessarily have to sit in one particular way. If you do not find it comfortable to sit in the lotus position, that's all right. That doesn't mean you're bad at meditating. But again, start small, start nice and short. And if you want to, you can work your way up to longer periods of meditation. There are plenty of different resources out there to help you find new ways to meditate. But I would also point out that there are some folks for various reasons, whether they be physical or mental related conditions, some folks are not going to find meditation helpful and may, in fact, if they continue to try it, will find it to be a problem for them. And so while I know that there are folks out there who will tell you that you can solve all your life's problems with the application of meditation, yoga, and a little extra kale in your diet, that is not actually the case. And so if meditation is not for you, that's also a perfectly valid thing.
Yep. Our listing of these are to give you options and to remind us all that there are a variety of different options for people to engage in contemplative practices. There is not a one-size-fits-all model. And in fact, meditation is not something that resonates with me. During CPE, at one point we did guided meditation, and there are a ton of guided meditations out there. We did one that used cussing to meditate. I think we did it after the pandemic had started. And that was F that, but the actual full word.
Sure.
It was really jarring for me, and it really resonated for some other people. So those sorts of things were if you're okay, that meditation I think works, but the language is too fluffy. Try one of those. It's like the adult coloring books, right? There are adult coloring books that are not suitable for work, and there are adult coloring books that are suitable for work. You know what fits and resonates for you best. But there are a lot of ways to engage in alternative forms of meditation. And I think it's interesting in my own life, the things that I look back on and I'm like, oh, throughout my life, I have engaged in alternative forms of meditation without even realizing that that was what I was doing. So when I was on the ski team and I was waxing my skis, there's something about that repetitive nature of putting the wax on, of scraping it off and then brushing it and then brushing it with a finer brush, right? If you're taking care of horses and you're brushing horses, it can be like that. Photography can be like that, especially if you're in the dark room by yourself and you're just slowly moving through the steps of developing, like, the old-fashioned way, if you will, developing photos, doing a puzzle. Puzzles help my brain relax and help open my brain. Knitting and crocheting can be really helpful for people, but those things where you're doing something, a lot of times it's where you're doing something repetitive, where your brain doesn't have to focus on what you're doing. And so then your brain can do the other things that it needs to do.
Absolutely.
Also, there are a lot of ways that art can be a contemplative practice. We've talked about some in terms of developing photographs or praying in color, but there are a lot of, during Advent and Lent especially, people will do like a photo a day calendar and have a word prompt. Caitlin Curtis, who is a wonderful author, native author, does in the month of May a word prompt every day for poetry and writes a poem every day and invites those of us who follow her and get her newsletter to join her in that. And so I did an art a day instead of a poem a day. But doodling, all of those things can be contemplative. Writing poetry can be contemplative. Journaling can be contemplative. The trick with what is contemplative a lot of the time is, are you being intentional about it?
Yeah.
Do you know what your hopes are for it? Not that your contemplative practice has to like have a goal of, I'm going to discover what I want to do for the rest of my life. But are you doing it for the purpose of contemplation? Are you doing it for the purpose of entertainment? Are you doing it for the purpose of socialization? All of those different things. And it can be more than one thing, but having that intentionality of, okay, I want to do this because I want to take this space for contemplation. And this is how I want to try and do that. And in that realm, one of the things that I don't think gets enough credit for being a spiritual practice is generosity and budgeting and stewardship. And so when you figure out your budget for the next month, or when you figure out where you want to give money, whether you tithe or you give offerings or you have a certain amount that you just have budgeted to give away each month, both in how you decide what you do in terms of generosity and also the deciding where it goes and how you do it can be a really beautiful contemplative practice where you get to reflect on money and in particular the ways that God can work through money. God doesn't always work through money because there's a lot of evil that happens through money, but God can also work through the generosity of us and of our time and of our treasures. And I think that's a lesser known and lesser appreciated form of contemplative practice and spiritual. So yeah. I always like give it an extra plug.
Although to be fair, your budgeting may not be entirely silent if you are budgeting with someone else with whom you share your finances. But even then,
also,
it is a useful thing to contemplate, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Or even by yourself, it might not be silent, depending on what your budget is, because
and how much you're sparing at your own math abilities, yeah.
Yes. Reminder, capitalism, not an inherent good. You can check out our episode where we did a deep dive on capitalism with Professor Felipe Maya for more on that.
Mm-hmm.
Also, let us know what your favorite practices are. Did we miss one?
Yeah.
Are one of these ones that you love and you want people to know that you love, that you hate, that you want people to know is terrible? Let us know and we will gladly either just appreciate on our own or share your responses depending on your desire.
Yeah, if you're really good at contemplative prayer and want to offer Emily and I some tips, by all means, feel free. Just don't imagine that those tips will necessarily, you know, work, but we'll try. So
we'll try them and we'll pass them along, probably.
Sure. They might work for someone, even if they don't work for us. So our first reading for this episode is from 1 Kings chapter 19, verses 9 through 18. The prophet Elijah is frustrated with the people of Israel, so God comes to him in the sound of sheer silence and assures him that God will continue to work through him.
So one of the themes in this reading is the unexpected presence. So like thinking about all of those different times, like that trope of talking about someone and then they come up behind you and you get caught talking about them, right? Which happens, I think, at least once in every TV show.
Oh, it has to, sure.
And very frequently in movies.
And I still very much enjoy the "he's standing right behind me" trope, don't you? It's just one of my favorites.
Yeah, they're standing behind me, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially like kids with teachers.
Oh, yes.
I watched Xenon, Girl of the 21st Century, rewatched.
Oh, I love that movie.
Because I love that movie. I rewatched them all when I was in Iowa at the beginning of July, and Xenon does that multiple times, yeah, where she's, like, talking about, like, the commander of the space station, and then she's like,
yes,
he's right behind me, isn't he? Yep, yep.
Yeah, I believe the person who tends to be right behind people the most often in the TV show The West Wing is the president, which he does so well.
Yes. That is also a good one. And then as we dive into the verses, in verse 10b, Elijah is answering God and says, "I alone am left, and they are seeking my life to take it away." And my first reaction was like, okay, Elijah, let's do a little bit of chalting. A lot of people talk about halting in our house because so many people are ADHD. Caffeine also gets its own letter. But the like check-in, are you caffeinated, hungry, angry, lonely, tired? Let's take care of those things and then reassess the problem. Right. And it sounds like Elijah's pretty lonely. And, you know, he's in this like weird space. It's kind of like the X-Men in the third X-Men movie in the like trilogy. There's a battle between mutants led by Magneto and humans. And this, the like seven or so X-Men or whatever are like this little line between the two warring groups trying to hold the peace. And like that space, yeah, feels really lonely.
Yeah. And then in verse 11b, we read, "Now there was a great wind, so strong that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake." Sometimes I just like to point out that we do in fact have scriptural proof that not all natural disasters are specifically God-directed at specific people or to be a specific signal about a specific thing. Like, I don't know if we'll be able to find it for the episode, but there was a meme some time ago, a picture of a landscape after a severe thunderstorm, and most everything is just like wet from the rain, but mm-hmm. there's one tree in particular that is very clearly charred, and there is an arrow pointing at it, and there's a caption that basically says that God said, "Screw that tree in particular." And people tend to interpret a lot of natural disasters or nature or weather as signs from God. But like, just go back and watch the movie Twister again and remember that weather is not a punishment from God, if that's what you need to do. Weather is science. Science is good. Science was mm-hmm. created by God, but God did not create science at us individually, particularly in order to use it against mm-hmm. us. That is not how this works.
And sometimes harmful weather is in fact a consequence of our collective actions, and especially the actions of corporations,
or inaction,
in yeah. advancing climate change in the wrong direction.
Absolutely.
Although I do always appreciate when like the super conservative Christians are like, "It's the queers, it's because of the gay people." And I'm like, you know, I wish I was that powerful that I could like control the storms and like that I could be a reason for a storm, because the world would be different. Like, never mind orcas. We got some like storms to come in too. Whew.
Like, if all you needed to get mutant superpowers was to be queer, the world would be an extremely different place.
So delightful. I'm just going to say, so delightful.
We're amazing. It depends on which superpowers, but yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, then in verse 12, we continue, "And after the earthquake, a fire, but God was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence." So clearly this is not the Christian Pentecost because God was not in the fire, which is a little bit disappointing because I love when God is in the fire. Again,
sure.
We'll link. You can listen to our fire episode from this year. Although our Patreon supporters, we love fire so much that we had an uncut version even without a guest. Because yeah. Fire is that amazing.
Absolutely.
But then I was like, well, maybe God is like a pair of really high quality noise canceling headphones. I have a pair and they have their like regular noise canceling stuff that like sometimes makes my ears feel weird. But then they have their like turn on the battery operated noise canceling. And that is sheer silence if I've ever heard it. Like it is weird how sheer the silence is.
And let me tell you, anybody who has ever chaperoned a youth church lock-in can tell you that the sound of silence when you get home from having done so is absolutely directly from God and a gift.
It's true. It's true. It's true. And not the silence from Doctor Who, as we already established.
Right.
I guess.
I mean, they're interesting, but yeah, not that kind of silence is what we're talking about. And then in verse 13, we read, when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And Elijah is not wrapping himself in a fireplace mantle in this verse, the shelf over a fireplace, just to be clear. We don't actually use the word mantle very often.
Okay, but now you have me on like, you know, the painted sets and like the stuff where it's like, if you look at it from one perspective, it's this thing. And if you look at it from another, sure. And it makes no sense. And now I want like a blanket or something that looks like that, and then just like take that blanket and wrap it around yourself.
That would be excellent. Yeah, I could totally see that as a cartoon. However, when we're talking about Elijah in the Bible, in ancient times, the mantle was a piece of clothing that was worn over one's tunic around the shoulders, and it might also include a hood attached to it. If you've ever seen a version of Robin Hood or another story set in medieval-ish times, you've probably seen one. It looks kind of like a pair of short sleeves from a t-shirt with a little bit of cloth between them to connect them, and then also there's a neck hole, and like I said, maybe a hood attached or not. Mm-hmm. And so Elijah's version probably has a hood if he's wrapping his whole head in it, but yeah. It was a additional piece of cloth to sort of keep the top of your shirt dry if you got caught in the rain, and also added some visual interest, as I'm sure you've noticed with costuming in various times when you've seen it. You'll also see them at Renaissance fairs, and actually quite often if you're watching adaptations of Shakespeare.
Hmm. It's so. Also like kind of fashionable. Or it was at some point.
Yeah.
I remember seeing it in fashion-y thing.
Yeah. And also, like, they can even become, like, a capelet or, like, an elbow-length cape.
Yeah.
If you get really fancy with them. And those came back for a while. How and people options? Have designed all sorts of different scarves that sort of work that way, too. So there's lots of different versions these days. But mostly it was just an extra piece of cloth to keep between yourself and the weather and keep your neck warm.
I really want it to be a fireplace mantle now, though, so just going to think of, like, bricks wrapped around Elijah. And...
Oh, you know what it makes me think of now is there's sort of a takeoff on claymation animation where instead of everything being made out of clay, everything is made out of little knit things, like
yes,
knit
yeah.
You could do that scene with everything made out of knit stuff, little knit figures, and then he could take the fireplace mantle off the fireplace and wrap it around his head.
That's adorable.
I love that.
Can we do that for Let's Make a Puppets Musical?
That's a lot of knitting. We'll need to bring some people in. Okay, folks, if you like to knit, please contact us and we'll see if we can get this going.
Yes, because that would be amazing. I would love that. I know somebody who does a lot of stop animation and is really good at it. So sure. I'm just saying. Yeah. Our next reading is Romans chapter 10, verses 5 through 15. In his letter to the Romans, Paul explains the importance of sharing the gospel with those who have not heard it and reminds them that God does not care about human distinction. So one of the themes in this passage is making Jesus fit us. So there's this like pressure, it feels like, in part of this Romans of like, remember, Jesus doesn't care about the things that we care about. The things that we care about aren't the things that God cares about necessarily. And so it reminded me of the game that little kids in particular and babies have of like, they have like all these different shapes, like squares and stars and circles and all of those things. And you have to put the like peg in the hole. You have to put the circle in the circle. And sometimes every once in a while, like a square will fit in a round hole or a round peg will fit in a square hole or something, just because of like the particularities of size and shape and stuff. That doesn't mean that it actually describes the thing particularly well or accurately. So just because you can make Jesus fit into your idea of, you know, who is hated and who is not and who is valuable and who is not, doesn't mean that Jesus actually thinks that anybody is hated or invaluable.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, by invaluable, I mean not valuable.
Right.
That word can mean multiple things.
True. Okay. Fair. So as we jump into the verses, in verse 5, we read, Moses writes concerning the righteousness that comes from the law, that the person who does these things will live by them. Now, there are a few different ways that you can take this verse, which is true for most verses in the Bible, to be fair. But basically, as I read it today, I'm reading this as what you do is who you truly are. And in Lord of the Rings, we see the corruption of several characters who consider taking or keeping the One Ring from Bilbo or from Frodo, even if they don't actually choose to keep or take it. But we see what they're capable of as they imagine it. I'm specifically thinking of, there's a bit with Gandalf. There was a scene with Galadriel where she considered being, you know, the evil elf queen kind of thing. Except for Samwise Gamgee, who is the one character to take and then freely give up the ring at the end of the Two Towers without any outside coercion at all. That's in the book version. I don't remember exactly where that happens in the movie version, but
yeah, it does happen.
Yeah.
It's true. Samwise.
Yay.
I love Samwise. And then as we continue in verse 8, we read, but what does it say? The word is near you, on your lips and in your heart. That is the word of faith that we proclaim. And this was what made me first think of the breath prayer, particularly with the Tetragrammaton that we talked about in the deep dive. And that, and the idea behind it that I don't think I like really went into in the deep dive though, is that because your breath can be the Tetragrammaton, then there's this idea that like the first word on your lips is the proper name of God, and the last word before you die is the proper name of God. And so this like this idea that the word is near you, on your lips and in your heart, like it just connects so beautifully. I really like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then in verse 10, we read, for one believes with the heart and so is justified, and one confesses with the mouth and so is saved. Just a reminder, this is one believes with the heart, not the mind, as in one trusts, not understands completely. One trusts. And I think Mirabelle from Encanto is one of the best characters for this, because she does this with the magic of the house. Like, she trusts the magic of the house, even when she feels a little bit betrayed and a little bit left out. But, like, she trusts the magic of the house. She doesn't understand how it works, like, the particularities of how it works, even when it can't be explained, even when she can't, like, explain with logic why she knows that the house is communicating these things. There is just such a component of faith and belief and trust from Mirabelle for the house and its magic.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in verse 12, we read, for there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. The same Lord is Lord of all and is generous to all who call on him. And this is much like how, when Maia in The Goblin Emperor became Emperor of the Elflands, people realized that instead of the elves always receiving superior treatment as they always had before, because the emperors had always been only elves before, now that someone who is half elf, half goblin is emperor, goblins will receive better treatment. And in fact, actually, their relationship with the neighboring goblin kingdom improves mightily. So sometimes who's in charge really does matter.
It's true. It's true. Representation is not the be-all end-all, but it is important.
Yeah, and a start. And our gospel reading for this Sunday is from Matthew chapter 14, verses 22 through 33. Struggling with their boat in difficult weather, the disciples are at first afraid when Jesus approaches them on the water, then amazed when Peter joins Jesus on the water, and then in awe when the weather stills as Jesus joins them on the boat.
So one of the themes in this passage is stormy faith. The faith of the disciples is like, you know, up and down and a lot of confusion, kind of like the storm they're in. And it reminded me of Moana's journey of faith in herself throughout the movie, because she starts out and she's tentative, but like pretty sure, and then has a setback and is like a little bit like doubted and told not to by her parents. And so like has more self-doubt and then like continues. And it's just this like navigating what she thinks she's supposed to do, what she thinks is the right answer, and then realizing that that she knows the deeper truths in the process that are necessary to continue and to weather the storm.
Yeah.
And I like that model of faith and doubt and storms.
Yeah, absolutely. And then in verse 22, we read, "Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the crowds." So this story starts right back up again after the feeding of the 5,000, which, yes, is actually way more than just 5,000, but at least 5,000 plus a bunch of other people. Mm-hmm. So Jesus got a short break before feeding the crowds, and then he fed them, and now he's apparently giving the disciples another break by sending them off into a boat.
And getting a break from the disciples himself.
You know, I'm sure that was probably necessary as well. Only instead, of course, of it being a, you know, restful break for them, it turns a little bit more into something like the boat ride in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. So I don't know how much rest they actually get from this, but, you know, Fair. They tried.
Yeah, you know, trying, that's half the battle.
Yeah.
Some say 90% showing up. And then in verse 23... we read that after Jesus had dismissed the crowds, he went up the mountain by himself to pray. And when evening came, he was there alone. That's because mountains are the best. Jesus went to the mountains to pray because mountains are the best. Because if you have ever been in the mountains, speaking of hiking is a great contemplative practice. If you've ever been in the mountains, it is gorgeous. But also, please, for the love of your own life, pay attention to the weather Absolutely. Before you go up and in process. But yeah. It is gorgeous. There is something beautiful and holy about mountains. We used to joke that while it was a long distance call to God from all these other places in the world, from Rome and all of that stuff, in Vail, where I grew up, which is a mountain town, it was a local call.
I was lovely. And I'm sure Moses knew it was on Sinai too. Yeah.
Exactly. And then in verse 26, as Jesus is coming to the disciples, when the disciples saw Jesus walking on the lake, they were terrified, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out in fear. And as a recent ghost semi-expert here, which is to say, horror nerds at church just finished our ghost season, not many ghosts actually seem to walk. The ones that do tend to like think that they're still alive, a la Ghost, The Sixth Sense, that sort of thing. But most of them like fly and float and stuff. So it's not really plausible. Like, Jesus probably not a ghost because of the whole like God omniscient thing. Jesus probably knew he was alive still and would know if he had died. Although the perceived walking on water could be an indicator of ghost activity, it seems like we need to investigate further.
I mean, yes, but also Jesus just fed thousands of people from 5 loaves of bread. So, like, miracle is also not out of the picture in terms of options.
It's true, but apparently it was not an option that the disciples considered.
True, that is fair, yeah. And then in verse 27 we read, "But immediately Jesus spoke to them and said, 'Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid.'" And for me, the thing that always comes to mind when a character comes out of the darkness and it turns out they're not a bad guy after all, in fact, this is one of your friends, is the TV show Are You Afraid of the Dark from Nickelodeon in the 90s. And the show starts with the characters gathering at a campfire to tell scary stories each episode. And often, as someone gets closer to the fire, they will try to scare the folks who are already there before revealing who they really are. And so that's what always pops into my head when somebody, you know, sneaks out of the shadows and says, "Nope, it's me. You're okay."
Solid memories. I don't think I watched that show, but I think I watched the show right before it. So I always saw like the beginning of that one. Yeah, that's a stake. And now for our least silent segment, let's make a Muppets musical. Okay, who are you casting this week for Muppets?
So I was kind of torn between the first and the gospel readings.
Right.
In terms of where did I want to go, in terms of like finding God in the silence and also like being able to quiet a storm. And in terms of who would be the absolute worst at finding God in the silence, and in terms of who I would expect would be able to quiet a storm but would not do so silently in any way, would be Miss Piggy. Miss Piggy could absolutely have enough stubbornness to get a storm to just stop already, but I don't think she would stop it with, you know, a quiet word or a gesture like Jesus is often portrayed as doing. Instead, I think there would be some yelling involved. And insofar as finding God in the silence as Elijah did, I'm not really sure Miss Piggy would, you know, go there herself, but she would be perfectly happy to hear Kermit talk about it later.
That is fantastic. I love that.
How about you?
I am still stuck on the stop animation knitting mantle of Elijah. And then it like got me to like the bricks. Because sometimes the inanimate objects are Muppets. And so like having the bricks of a fireplace, I'm thinking about like the Muppets Christmas Carol. Having the bricks be Muppets and then have them just like wrap around and give a hug to like a Gonzo-y Elijah.
Excellent.
I think
it
would be really good. And Gonzo works really well for Elijah because like at some point he flies. Like,
yeah. Thanks for joining us. Catch us next time when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the 12th Sunday after Pentecost. This podcast has been produced by us, Kay Roloff and Emily Ewing. For more fun, check us out on Twitter and Facebook at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
Also, if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. Starting at just $5 a month, it is cheaper than a whole class on contemplative practices or a horse or skiing hobbies.
Now I'm trying to imagine how you would sound edit a podcast about contemplative silent practices.
I love
it. It's cheaper than learning how to do that, I bet. Yeah,
I bet it is.
Also, let us know on Facebook or Twitter who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christian said, Pax Vobiscum.